genocide begins with language, by demonizing the minority, by reducing them to something less than human, something like an insect, a vermin, a parasite, a germ.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. A young woman, a golf prodigy, launches a perfect drive and kills a golf caddy at a Tony New York country club. Investigations and hidden scandals soon follow. So begins best-selling Vermont author Chris Bojalian's spellbinding new book, The Amateur. His 26th novel is classic Bojalian, a riveting tale told by a female protagonist that weaves together mystery, intrigue, romance, betrayal, and secrets that had me frantically turning the page to find out what happened next. Chris Bojalian is among Vermont's most beloved and prolific authors of literary and historical fiction. His work has been translated into 35 languages, been made into 3 movies, and an Emmy-nominated TV series, The Flight Attendant, on HBO Max. He's also written 3 plays. The New York Times Book Review named The Amateur one of the novels everyone will be talking about in 2026. Bojalian has won numerous literary awards and also been recognized for his efforts to educate Americans about the Armenian Genocide. He wrote the Idle Banter column for the Burlington Free Press for nearly 25 years and has also written for the New York Times, Washington Post, and other publications. He is a graduate of Amherst College. Chris Bojalian spoke to me from his home in Weybridge, Vermont, shortly before heading out on a national book tour for The Amateur. Chris Bojalian, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You have described your latest book, The Amateur, as your secret novel. You wrote it in a summer, not telling anyone, delivering the whole manuscript to your editor. So tell us the whole story, where you got the idea for this, and why you wrote it in secret.
I wrote The Amateur in secret because I thought it was absolute madness. And I imagined trying to describe what I was doing to anyone and just seeing the eye roll. I've written a lot of books, but this one was different because I was writing a pretend memoir of a fictional version of me, a female novelist now just on the far side of 60, finally exercising all of her demons. Moreover, I would also be the secondary player, Kenny Foster, a young 18-year-old caddy who's killed in the prologue of the novel. So I told no one what I was doing because the idea of taking sort of the superego and id parts of me and dividing them into the two major characters of the novel seemed crazy. So I told no one about it because I knew no one was waiting desperately for a new book from me. I had time. This was the summer of 2024. The Princess of Las Vegas had just come out. My 2025 novel, The Jackal's Mistress, was all done. So it's not as if Doubleday Books was wondering what I was up to because I wasn't going to have a book for a while anyway. And obviously my wife knew I was doing something in my library. I was writing, experimenting, exploring. But I said, you know what?
You literally did not tell your wife what you were doing.
I literally did not tell my wife what I was doing. And this was a first because she's read every one of the 3.8 million words I've published before they were published.
I'm sorry, but this sounds like it could be the subject of a Chris Bojalian novel. The wife who thinks her husband is writing a novel in the office, but something terrible and very much not that is happening.
I don't know. Sounds more like a Stephen King novel. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And there's Shelley Duvall picking up the pieces of typewriter paper and seeing that it's the same sentence for thousands of pages. Now, that wasn't what was occurring in my library here in Weybridge.
So your friend Stephen Kiernan texted to tell me he thinks this is perhaps your best, and also that it's very autobiographical. I know you grew up in the suburbs of New York City. This opens in the suburbs of New York City at a golf course. I believe you were a caddy at one time, and this opens with a scene of a caddy, a very ill-fated caddy. Is it autobiographical in some respect?
It is autobiographic in so many respects. More on that in a split second, but first I do have to give a shout out to my buddy Stephen Kiernan. That was really kind of him, because Stephen is a spectacularly talented novelist, and goodness knows I sure loved his most recent book, Pollock's Last Lover. So is The Amateur autobiographic? Completely, in so many ways. First of all, yes, I caddied for summers in high school at exactly that sort of country club. And I loved it. It was a great job because you were paid in cash. It was a lot of money by my standards. And I had a chance to read for 90 minutes a day between my morning loop and my afternoon loop. So I was rich by my standards. Most of it was college book money, but still, I was rich by my standards. I had a great tan. I was crazy buffed, and I was getting to read a ton. These were lovely summers. But I was also deeply aware of something I would not have referred to necessarily as the class divide in America, but this. We had just moved from Miami, Florida, to a suburb of New York City before, or as soon as I finished 10th grade. So my first summer caddying would be the summer between 10th and 11th grade. And it dawned on me the following summer, the summer between 11th and 12th grade, that all I did was caddy for my classmates' fathers and occasionally mothers. My family could never have been able to afford that country club. We were never going to be members. And I was the only member of that high school who caddied there. All of the other caddies were either grizzled veterans who would caddy in a place like Siwanoy Country Club, where I caddied in the summer, and then go to West Palm Beach or Phoenix or someplace to the south in the winter, or students from a nearby Catholic college, usually day students at this college. Those were the caddies. And so often I was given the kids who went to the high school's parents because the caddy master thought, "Oh, he knows their son. He knows their daughter." And this was probably the fundamental inspiration for the beginning of the book. It's not a book about golf. It really isn't. I mean, I've had so many people say things to me along the lines of, "Wow, I was kind of not interested in this book at first because I thought it was about golf." Or they would say to me the reverse. They said, "Oh my God, I was so grateful to get a galley of this book because I love golf." But they would then say the same things. But there's hardly any golf in it. And the reason for that is this. The fictional version of me, who's the novelist half, Mira Winston, acknowledges in the prologue that this is a memoir, and she's telling this story because she spent the last 40 years of her life consumed and obsessed with how one small moment changed the trajectory of her entire life. When she was 18, she thought she was going to go to Yale and then go to the LPGA. She was a golf prodigy. She beat the men daily at her country club. But then, one Thursday in August, she drives a golf ball through the practice net at her Swain Country Club, instantly killing a classmate and caddy, Kenny Foster, and her life completely goes off the rails.
That's a pretty good teaser. And I will say that in the intro, where you describe with sort of exquisite angst and detail that life of the caddy and the class divide that he straddles, catering to the wealthy people in his community that he is not, that his family will never be, there, the autobiographical element
Definitely pokes its head through the grass on the putting green. And it's clear that you know of what you speak there.
I do. Some of the most autobiographic moments from the Kenny Foster portion of the novel include his bedroom and all of the posters of Casey and the Sunshine Band that are on the walls, or the leisure suits and the polyester huckapoo shirts that he made the mistake of bringing with him to Miami from Miami, Florida, to Westchester County, where they were utterly laughable. As I said, I've got very fond memories of being a caddy, but by the second summer I was doing it, I was also really aware of the reality that I was seeing a world that I might never see from any vantage point other than the guy carrying two golf bags and sometimes also catering to two more golfers in a golf cart and their putters.
I want to ask you, your protagonist in your new novel, Mira Winston, is like many of your novels, you write from a woman's perspective and in a woman's voice. How and why do you do this? And you have often been praised, but I'm guessing you've probably also been criticized. So tell me about this knack and talent of yours.
One of the things Mira Winston shares in the novel is her belief that the only reason why golf was invented was so that men would talk to each other. I figured out pretty early on as a caddy that golf was the perfect sport for uptight, emotionally closed off men to converse. Because you never have to make eye contact. You are walking for hours, staring straight ahead. You're keeping your eye on the golf ball. Or in those moments of extreme silence, you are staring down at the golf ball before you whack it or putt it. So men would reveal things on the golf course that they wouldn't reveal any place else. I mention that because so many of the characters in my novels make emotional journeys that I'm convinced men of a certain generation or a certain era would never make. For instance, a book like The Sandcastle Girls, a love story set amidst the Armenian genocide. The entire thing that sends Laura Petrosian on a search for her family's history is one photograph she sees at the Armenian Museum of America in Watertown, Massachusetts. I don't believe a male version of Laura Petrosian would be inspired by one photograph to do such a deep dive into her life that could completely unearth secrets she doesn't need to know. Mira Winston is another one of those characters that if she were a man, I think it would be a very, very different story. As much as this is a book about the class divide in America, it is also about the way women are seen or not seen, or what they are seen for, and the predatory men all around many young women. Sometimes Mira Winston in the novel talks about the ways she would act out at 18, 19, and 20. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But among them is this. She's a terrific athlete and a ferocious competitor. And instead, she is constantly diminished as a girl athlete or an athlete that the men around her don't take seriously, as unbelievably talented as she is. And this is frustrating. And of course, she's writing now, looking back with a lot of hindsight. But she's finally beginning to acknowledge that when she was 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20, virtually every adult who was supposed to look out for her didn't. No one had Mira Winston's best intentions in their grasp.
Tell me about your ability and the challenge to write as a man from a woman's perspective. And what perhaps your limitations are, although you've often been praised for doing this exceedingly well.
I am told by a lot of people things like this, usually by women. You and Wally Lamb and Stephen King write women really well. Most men don't, which is kind of the ultimate backhanded compliment, and I get it. I totally get it. I never want to culturally appropriate topics that don't belong to me. I wrote a novel, a transgender love story, that was actually a Lambda Literary Finalist back in the year 2000, Transistor Radio, and I'm proud of that book. But I wouldn't write that book in 2026 because there are so many wonderful trans voices that should be telling those stories, not me. But writing across gender is different. Imagine if you were to say to a 34-year-old female novelist, here's your palette. Things you've experienced in the last 34 years of your life as a woman. That's what you got. So I'm very comfortable writing across gender, and I'm fine when people quibble with some of my details. But I mean, some of the greatest compliments I've gotten in my life include the reality that I do write across gender often, to wit. One of the very first trade reviews of midwives, way back in 1996, ended with this paragraph. An added benefit of this novel is the candor and the honesty with which Chris Bohjalian writes about her experiences in labor and what it must have been like for her to give birth. To this day, I will meet readers at events who will tell me, until I looked at the dust jacket of midwives, or I looked at the back cover of the flight attendant, I thought you were a woman. Or I've been reading your books for years, and it was only 4 years ago that I realized you're a man. And those are unbelievable gifts.
Why are you drawn to it, and what gives you the sensitivity to do this?
First of all, thank you. Let's assume that I do have the sensitivity to do that, and then I will address why I'm drawn to it. I have no idea why I have the sensitivity to do it, but I do know this. I went to five schools in 6 years in three states. I was always that new kid trying to figure out how one fits in a new high school culture. Scott Fitzgerald talks about how writers are often that kid with his or her, their fingertips pressed against the glass window, looking inside at the party they weren't invited to. I think that's a factor in why I'm capable of doing whatever it is I am capable of doing. And why am I drawn to women's stories? It's not necessarily that I'm drawn to women's stories. The Sandcastle Girls didn't have to be a woman's story, Laura Petrosian's. I do it because I think a woman is more likely than a man to go on the emotional odyssey that the tale demands. Now, Mira Winston, I knew from the moment I started to write, was going to be a female version of me because I did want to get not merely at the class divide, but the spectacular frustration that this woman is feeling because, first of all, no one took her seriously as an athlete once upon a time. And secondly, because no one looked out for her when she was surrounded by creepy male golfers.
I want to pick up a thread you've mentioned here in talking about Sandcastle Girls. And that is the Armenian genocide and your commitment and tenacity in writing about this issue. And you have a Substack essay that you wrote recently in which you bring this into the present and you write, "These days, the language of genocide is everywhere." Explain what you mean and your connection to the Armenian genocide.
First of all, for the listeners who are unfamiliar with the Armenian genocide, this is the Reader's Digest condensed version. Between 1915 and 1923, though the vast majority during the First World War, the Ottoman Empire systematically annihilated 1.5 million Armenians, 300,000 Assyrians, and countless Greeks. They were striving for a homogeneous new Ottoman Empire, or what Ataturk would call a new modern Turkey, a Turkey without minorities to mess things up. The young Nazis revered the young Turks. Make no mistake, the Himmlers, the Hitlers, they revered Jamal and Talat Pasha. My grandparents, two of them, survived the Armenian genocide and would emigrate to the United States, where my father would be born months after my grandmother arrived at Ellis Island. So yes, I do feel a stake in educating people about the Armenian genocide, especially its links to the Holocaust. As one of the characters, well, Laura Petrosian, says in The Sandcastle Girls, and this is the most quoted sentence from that novel, there's a link between the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, the Cambodian killing fields, Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur. It's a very long list, but really, kind reader, how much genocide can one sentence handle? So, that essay you just mentioned in Substack, genocide begins with language, by demonizing the minority, by reducing them to something less than human, something like an insect, a vermin, a parasite, a germ. And just as the Ottoman Empire used that language about the Armenians, or the Nazis used that sort of language about the Jewish citizens of Europe, increasingly in the United States, we see immigrants or people from other countries demonized in much the same way. Goodness gracious, just one example off the top of my head, the horrific ways in the fall of 2024, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump and other Republicans were demonizing Ohio Haitian citizens, claiming that they were so animalistic they ate dogs and cats. Now, we don't talk about that story anymore because demonizing Haitians accomplished what the Republicans wanted it to accomplish, and they've moved on to demonizing other immigrant communities as necessary. Now, I want to stress that when I'm talking about the language genocide in the United States, it is a very small minority of people who use it. Unfortunately, there are a small minority of people who control a lot of the levers of government right now. And I should also note that there are a lot of Republicans out there who do not use the language of genocide. Good Lord, my mother died a Barry Goldwater Republican. So I do not want to demonize all Republicans. I simply want to make the point that it is a group of people in the United States right now using the language of genocide in ways that I find alarming.
What do you think is being teed up here?
Well, you can see that what was being teed up were the sorts of ICE roundups that led to people who should never have been rounded up being deported. You've seen it in the way that Renee Good or Alex Preddy were murdered in Minneapolis this past winter, the way there have been inadvertent, accidental, or simply incompetent murders of other American citizens more recently by ICE. It's an attempt to bring back a homogeneous America that never really existed, but that some people in the United States think existed or pine for.
Chris, what do you fear right now? As somebody with this very visceral and direct link to a genocide, what worry, what concerns you most right now in our society?
I bike a lot, and I biked yesterday past a sign that said, "My outrage cannot fit on this sign." I mean, some of the biggest problems facing the country are problems facing the world. We barely talk about global climate change, and global climate change is a real existential threat, in my opinion. I vacillate wildly between whether I believe that democracy in America is really in jeopardy, or simply believing that we are in a cycle right now where there is a stupidity, a cruelty, and a savagery that is cyclical, and eventually we will swing back. I am no fan of incompetence, and I'm not sure that what worries me more now is brutality or incompetence, but we seem to have a lot of both.
Weaving this back into your work as a novelist, I understand you once tried to write a book about the Armenian genocide that just flopped. And then you took another run at it in The Sandcastle Girls, which was extremely successful. What did you do there?
Well, first of all, the first time I wrote about the Armenian genocide, it flopped in my opinion, but it didn't flop commercially or critically because I never published it. My BS
Okay.
meter was really clear when I read this book that this is simply one young Armenian American raging at the system but not offering readers a good novel. So I put it aside and wrote something else, you know, this thing about a midwife on trial for manslaughter, and that worked out fine, thank you very much. The second time I tried, I was at least 9 or 10 books smarter, and I understood more about how to move characters around on a page, and I understood this. If you're going to write a novel about 1.5 million dead in the desert, you need to make sure that there is a darn good reason to keep people craving the next page. And I thought of some of the novels I'd loved, like The English Patient or Atonement, novels set in war that were love stories. And that's when I realized if you're going to write about the Armenian Genocide, make it a love story. So I did. And then the other thing that The Sandcastle Girls has, that I think my best work has, is an ending that is Aristotelian. And by that I mean this. It is at once surprising, but when you get over the surprise, you think to yourself, it couldn't have ended any other way. And I feel that way about my better books, such as Midwives, or The Amateur, or Hour of the Witch, or Skeletons at the Feast. I've written some terrible books, but the good ones usually have a good ending.
So that's the secret. Even if you think it's a terrible book, your readers may disagree with you. Give it a good ending and all is well.
I wouldn't say all is well, but when you look at a gymnast's floor routine in the Olympics, you always talk about, wow, he or she, they really stuck the landing. And that's important for novels too. I know readers can be really frustrated if they spend 340 pages with a book and the last 30 pages, it falls off a cliff and not in a good way.
You mentioned your 2000 book, Transistor Radio, which featured a transgender protagonist and the reactions to that person in a small Vermont town. Now, of course, trans folk are under attack, are being ostracized. What made you focus on this topic 25 years ago, and how do you reflect on the current anti-trans backlash?
I was inspired to write Transistor Radio because a friend of mine had fallen in love with a man who, in 1998, dropped what was for her a bombshell she hadn't seen coming, that he planned to transition and become a woman. And she loved this human being so much, but she couldn't wrap herself around the idea of loving this human being once this human being had transitioned. And so they broke up. But I remember her telling me, and my wife, that she wondered if this was the love of her life and she was walking away from it. So I decided to explore that as a novel. And I remember going to Trinidad, Colorado, where at the time, most male to female surgeries were conducted, and spending a week interviewing people the night before their surgical transition. And the reason why I was often with them the night before their surgical transition is because no one in their family was with them. Their only company the night before the surgery was a novelist from Vermont asking questions that arguably were none of his business. But I was really moved by that and the way these people had been so deserted by even their families. Now, here's what's different in 2026. As far as I can tell, very, very often families of the trans community are unbelievably supportive and are so there for their family members, which is so beautiful. But as you said, we are also seeing a backlash against the trans community, which goes back to some people in this country wanting a homogenous America that has, virtually no LGBTQ plus community.
I'm curious if Transistor Radio has been kind of, it was a, 25 years ago that you wrote it, but has it been part of the conversation and controversy now?
No, it's really not. And I don't promote the book because I feel that it's not my book, it's not my issue or my story to talk about. I'm always really flattered, and this happens at almost all my events. A reader will tell me that they grew so comfortable with the trans community after reading Transistor Radio, or they really grew to understand someone in their family or someone they cared about at work who is transitioning, and they understand it more now. And that is a great thing to hear.
You, among the many hats you've worn, you were a columnist for nearly 25 years for the Burlington Free Press. Your column was Idle Banter. I was a reader and a fan. The
Thank
Free
you.
Press is now a shadow of itself, and it is emblematic of so many local media outlets. Media deserts are expanding rapidly around the country and even around our state. How do you view, as a once an insider of that world, how do you view what's happening to local media, and why?
The dearth of local media is cataclysmic, which is why I'm so grateful to Vermont Digger. I'm so grateful to what you do. We talk a lot about things like, democracy dies in darkness. But the fact is, we need an educated electorate. We need an educated electorate to teach us about everything from what's going on with the school board, what's going on with the library expansion. We need local reporting, so we understand how a national issue affects our neighborhoods, whether it's energy tax credits from the federal government or the reality that the Vermont National Guard is being deployed to pick a country for a mission. And without local media to tell us this stuff, we don't know. And I think there's a correlation between the demise of local media, the consolidation of national media, and, for lack of a better word, know-nothing politics. when you're only getting your news from Pravda or Investia, when you're only getting your news from whatever is the mouthpiece that the federal government is using, it's problematic for a spirited and intelligent debate about issues.
So, Chris, this is your 26th novel that is about to debut. What is next for you?
I have a novel that is done that comes out in March of 2028. It is called The Wedding Cake. And I'm at work right now on a book for either 2029 or 2030 and a possible new play.
What excites you the most in your life right now? You've mentioned so many things that you, as you're an avid cyclist, as people of your social media will know, they go along, you bring people along on your rides with you. But of all the things you're doing, what are you most excited about?
The things that make me happiest are hanging around with my wife, hanging around with our daughter, who's an amazing young actor, being with my dog, blind but adorable. I mean, those are the gifts that I treasure. And I mean, I love writing in Vermont and living in Vermont. There's so many parts of this country that just dazzle me, so many parts of the world that just dazzle me, but Vermont is such a special place.
And your words of advice to somebody who wants to be the next Chris Bajalian.
Don't go there, dear God. I can't imagine why anyone would want to live their life to some of my demons. That point noted, I'm also unbelievably blessed. I'm unbelievably blessed to have the world's best lovely bride, the world's most amazing daughter, and the world's cutest dog. Those are all spectacular blessings. If you're wondering and you're a younger writer about writing, I would always say, first of all, write because you love it. Write in the genre you love to read. Write every day. I mean, I wrote my first three novels while employed full time at ad agencies, writing between 5 and 7 a.m. in the morning before going to work. And remember that the first draft isn't the last draft.
Well, I guess we will leave it there and look forward to your next draft. Chris Bajalian, thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Oh, David, you're such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Chris Bajalian is the best-selling author of 26 books. His latest novel is The Amateur, which comes out this summer. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.